old on October grouse, gunpowder bias, or because he sours the soil and enables it to grow the loveliest of our orchids, the showy lady slipper. On the other hand, foresters have excommunicated the tamarack because he grows too slowly to pay compound interest. In order to clinch this dispute, they also mention that he succumbs periodically to epizootics of sawfly. But this is 50 years hence for my tamaracks, so I shall let my grandson worry about that. Meanwhile, my tamaracks are growing so lustily that my spirits soar with them skyward. To me, an ancient cottonwood is the greatest of trees, because in his youth he shaded the buffalo and wore a halo of pigeons. And I like a young cottonwood because he may some day become ancient. But the farmer's wife, and hence the farmer, despises all cottonwoods because in June the female tree clogs the screens with cotton. The modern dogma is comfort at any cost. I find my biases more numerous than those of my neighbors, because I have individual likings for many species that they lump under one aspersive category, brush. Thus I like the wahoo, partly because deer, rabbits, and mice are so avid to eat his square twigs and green bark, and partly because his cerise berries glow so warmly against November snow. I like the red dogwood because he feeds October robins, and the prickly ash because my woodcock take their daily sunbath under the shelter of his thorns. I like the hazel because his October purple feeds my eye, and because his November catkins feed my deer and grouse. I like the bittersweet because my father did, or because the deer, on the 1st of July of each year, begins suddenly to eat the new leaves, and I have learned to predict this event to my guests. I cannot dislike a plant that enables me, a mere professor, to blossom forth annually as a successful seer and prophet. It is evident that our plant biases are in part traditional. If your grandfather liked hickory nuts, you will like the hickory tree because your father told you to. If, on the other hand, your grandfather burned a log carrying a poison ivy vine and recklessly stood in the smoke, you will dislike the species, no matter with what crimson glories it warms your eyes each fall. It is also evident that our plant biases reflect not only vocations, but avocations, with a delicate allocation of priority as between industry and indolence. The farmer who would rather hunt grouse than milk cows will not dislike hawthorn, no matter if it does invade his pasture. The coon hunter will not dislike basswood, and I know of quail hunters who bear no grudge against ragweed, despite their annual bout with hay fever. Our biases are indeed a sensitive index to our affections, our tastes, our loyalties, our generosities, and our manner of wasting weekends. Be that as it may, I am content to waste mine, in November, with axe in hand. A mighty fortress. Every farm woodland, in addition to yielding lumber, fuel, and posts, should provide its owner a liberal education. This crop of wisdom never fails, but it is not always harvested. I here record some of the many lessons I have learned in my own woods. Soon after I bought the woods a decade ago, I realized that I had bought almost as many tree diseases as I had trees. My woodlot is riddled by all the ailments wood is heir to. I began to wish that Noah, when he loaded up the ark, had left the tree diseases behind. But it soon became clear that these same diseases made my woodlot a mighty fortress, unequaled in the whole county. My woods is headquarters for a family of coons. Few of my neighbors have any. One Sunday in November, after a new snow, I learned why. The fresh track of a coon hunter and his hound led up to a half-uprooted maple, under which one of my coons had taken refuge. The frozen snarl of roots and earth was too rocky to chop and too tough to dig. The holes under the roots were too numerous to smoke out. The hunter had quit coonless because a fungus disease had weakened the roots of the maple. The tree, half-tipped over by a storm, offers an impregnable fortress for coondom. Without this bomb-proof shelter, my seed stock of coons would be cleaned out by hunters each year. My woods houses a dozen ruffled grouse, but during periods of deep snow, my grouse shift to my neighbor's woods, where there is better cover. However, I always retain as many grouse as I have oaks wind-thrown by summer storms. These summer windfalls keep their dried leaves, and during snows, each such windfall harbors a grouse. The droppings show that each grouse roosts, feeds, and loafs for the duration of the storm within the narrow confines of his leafy camouflage, safe from wind, owl, fox, and hunter. The cured oak leaves not only serve as cover, but, for some curious reason, are relished as food by the grouse. These oak windfalls are, of course, diseased trees. Without disease, few oaks would break off, and hence few grouse would have down tops to hide in. Diseased oaks also provide another apparently delectable grouse food, oak galls. A gall is a diseased growth of new twigs that have been stung by a gall wasp while tender and succulent. In October, my grouse are often stuffed with oak galls. Each year, the wild bees load up one of my hollow oaks with combs, and each year, trespassing honey hunters harvest the honey before I do. This is partly because they are more skillful than I am in lining up the bee trees, and partly because they use nets, and hence are able to work before the bees become dormant in fall. But for heart rots, there would be no hollow oaks to furnish wild bees with oaken hives. During high years of the cycle, there is a plague of rabbits in my woods. They eat the bark and twigs off almost every kind of tree or bush I am trying to encourage, and ignore almost every kind I should like to have less of. When the rabbit hunter plants himself a grove of pines or an orchard, the rabbit somehow ceases to be a game animal and becomes a pest instead. The rabbit, despite his omnivorous appetite, is an epicure in some respects. He always prefers a hand-planted pine, maple, apple, or wahoo to a wild one. He also insists that certain salads be preconditioned before he deigns to eat them. Thus he spurns red dogwood until it is attacked by oyster shell scale, after which the bark becomes a delicacy to be eagerly devoured by all the rabbits in the neighborhood. A flock of a dozen chickadees spends the year in my woods. In winter, when we are harvesting diseased or dead trees for our fuel wood, the ring of the axe is dinner gong for the chickadee tribe. They hang in the offing, waiting for the tree to fall, offering pert commentary on the slowness of our labor. When the tree at last is down, and the wedges begin to open up its contents, the chickadees draw up their white napkins and fall too. Every slab of dead bark is, to them, a treasury of eggs, larvae, and cocoons. For them, every ant-tunneled heartwood bulges with milk and honey. We often stand a fresh split against a nearby tree just to see the greedy chicks mop up the ant eggs. It lightens our labor to know that they, as well as we, derive aid and comfort from the fragrant riches of newly split oak. But for diseases and insect pests, there would likely be no food in these trees, and hence no chickadees to add cheer to my woods in winter. Many other kinds of wildlife depend on tree diseases. My pileated woodpeckers chisel living pines to extract fat grubs from the diseased heartwood. My barred owls find surcease from crows and jays in the hollow heart of an old basswood. But for this diseased tree, their sundown serenade would probably be silenced. My wood ducks nest in hollow trees. Every June brings its brood of downy ducklings to my woodland slough. All squirrels depend, for permanent dens, on a delicately balanced equilibrium between a rotting cavity and the scar tissue with which the tree attempts to close the wound. The squirrels referee the contest by gnawing out the scar tissue when it begins unduly to shrink the amplitude of their front door. The real jewel of my disease-ridden woodlot is the prothonotary warbler. He nests in an old woodpecker hole or other small cavity in a dead snag overhanging water. The flash of his golden-blue plumage amid the dank decay of the June woods is, in itself, proof that dead trees are transmuted into living animals, and vice versa. When you doubt the wisdom of this arrangement, take a look at the Prothonotary. December. Home Range. The wild things that live on my farm are reluctant to tell me, in so many words, how much of my township is included within their daily or nightly beat. I am curious about this, for it gives me the ratio between the size of their universe and the size of mine. And it conveniently begs the much more important question, who is the more thoroughly acquainted with the world in which he lives? Like people, my animals frequently disclose by their actions what they decline to divulge in words. It is difficult to predict when and how one of these disclosures will come to light. The dog, being no hand with an axe, is free to hunt while the rest of us are making wood. A sudden yip-yip-yip gives us notice that a rabbit, flushed from his bed in the grass, is headed elsewhere in a hurry. He makes a beeline for a woodpile a quarter mile distant, where he ducks between two corded stacks, a safe gunshot ahead of his pursuer. The dog, after leaving a few symbolic tooth marks on the hard oak, gives it up and resumes his search for some less canny cottontail, and we resume our chopping. This little episode tells me that this rabbit is familiar with all of the ground between his bed in the meadow and his blitz cellar under the woodpile. How else the beeline? This rabbit's home range is at least a quarter mile in extent. The chickadees that visit our feeding station are trapped and banded each winter. Some of our neighbors also feed chickadees, but none band them. By noticing the furthest points from my feeder at which banded chickadees are seen, we have learned that the home range of our flock is half a mile across in winter, but that it includes only areas protected from wind. In summer, when the flock has dispersed for nesting, banded birds are seen at greater distances, often mated with unbanded birds. At this season, the chickadees pay no heed to wind, often being found in open, wind-swept places. The fresh tracks of three deer, clear in yesterday's snow, pass through our woods. I follow the tracks backward and find a cluster of three beds, clear of snow, in the big willow thicket on the sandbar. I then follow the tracks forward. They lead to my neighbor's cornfield, where the deer have pawed waste corn out of the snow, and also tousled one of the shocks. The tracks then lead back, by another route, to the sandbar. En route, the deer have pawed at some grass tufts, nuzzling for the tender green sprouts within, and they have also drunk at a spring. My picture of the night's routine is complete. The overall distance from bed to breakfast is a mile. Our woods always harbors grouse. But one day last winter, after a deep and soft snow, I could find neither a grouse nor a track of one. I had about concluded that my birds had moved out when my dog came to a point in the leafy top of an oak blown down last summer. Three grouse flushed out, one by one. There were no tracks under or near the down top. Obviously, these birds had flown in, but from where? Grouse must eat, especially in zero weather. So I examined the droppings for a clue. Among much unrecognizable debris, I found bud scales and also the tough yellow skins of frozen nightshade berries. In a thicket of young soft maple, I had noticed, in summer, an abundant growth of nightshade. I went there and, after a search, found grouse tracks on a log. The birds had not waded the soft snow. They had walked the logs and picked the berries projecting here and there within their reach. This was a quarter mile east of the down oak. That evening, at sunset, I saw a grouse budding in a popple thicket a quarter mile west. There were no tracks. This completed the story. These birds, for the duration of the soft snow, were covering their home range a wing, not a foot, and the range was half a mile across. Science knows little about home range. How big it is at various seasons, what food and cover it must include, when and how it is defended against trespass, and whether ownership is an individual, family, or group affair. These are the fundamentals of animal economics, or ecology. Every farm is a textbook on animal ecology. Woodsmanship is the translation of the book. Pines above the snow. Acts of creation are ordinarily reserved for gods and poets, but humbler folk may circumvent this restriction if they know how. To plant a pine, for example, one need be neither god nor poet. One need only own a shovel. By virtue of this curious loophole in the rules, any clodhopper may say, "Let there be a tree, and there will be one." If his back is strong and his shovel sharp, there may eventually be 10,000. And in the seventh year, he may lean upon his shovel and look upon his trees and find them good. God passed on his handiwork as early as the seventh day, but I notice he has since been rather noncommittal about its merits. I gather either that he spoke too soon, or that trees stand more looking upon than do fig leaves and firmaments. Why is the shovel regarded as a symbol of drudgery? Perhaps because most shovels are dull. Certainly all drudges have dull shovels, but I am uncertain which of these two facts is cause and which effect. I only know that a good file, vigorously wielded, makes my shovel sing as it slices the mellow loam. I am told there is music in the sharp plane, the sharp chisel, and the sharp scalpel, but I hear it best in my shovel. It hums in my wrists as I plant a pine. I suspect that the fellow who tried so hard to strike one clear note upon the harp of time chose too difficult an instrument. It is well that the planting season comes only in spring, for moderation is best in all things, even shovels. During the other months, you may watch the process of becoming a pine. The pine's new year begins in May, when the terminal bud becomes the candle. Whoever coined that name for the new growth had subtlety in his soul. The candle sounds like a platitudinous reference to obvious facts. The new shoot is waxy, upright, brittle. But he who lives with pines knows that candle has a deeper meaning, for at its tip burns the eternal flame that lights a path into the future. May after May, my pines follow their candles skyward, each headed straight for the zenith, and each meaning to get there, if only there be years enough before the last trumpet blows. It is a very old pine who at last forgets which of his many candles is the most important, and thus flattens his crown against the sky. You may forget, but no pine of your own planting will do so in your lifetime. If you are thriftily inclined, you will find pines congenial company, for, unlike the hand-to-mouth hardwoods, they never pay current bills out of current earnings. They live solely on their savings of the year before. In fact, every pine carries an open bankbook, in which his cash balance is recorded by 30th June of each year. If, on that date, his completed candle has developed a terminal cluster of 10 or 12 buds, it means that he has salted away enough rain and sun for a 2-foot or even a 3-foot thrust skyward next spring. If there are only 4 to 6 buds, his thrust will be a lesser one, but he will nevertheless wear that peculiar air that goes with solvency. Hard years, of course, come to pines as they do to men, and these are recorded as shorter thrusts, i.e., shorter spaces between the successive whorls of branches. These spaces, then, are an autobiography that he who walks with trees may read at will. In order to date a hard year correctly, you must always subtract 1 from the year of lesser growth. Thus, the 1937 growth was short in all pines. This records the universal drought of 1936. On the other hand, the 1941 growth was long in all pines. Perhaps they saw the shadow of things to come and made a special effort to show the world that pines still know where they are going, even though men do not. When one pine shows a short year but his neighbors do not. You may safely interpolate some purely local or individual adversity. A fine scar, a gnawing meadow mouse, a windburn, or some local bottleneck in that dark laboratory we call the soil. There is much small talk and neighborhood gossip among pines. By paying heed to this chatter, I learn what has transpired during the week when I am absent in town. Thus, in March, when the deer frequently browse white pines, the height of the browsings tells me how hungry they are. A deer full of corn is too lazy to nip branches more than 4 feet above the ground. A really hungry deer rises on his hind legs and nips as high as 8 feet. Thus, I learn the gastronomic status of the deer without seeing them, and I learn, without visiting his field, whether my neighbor has hauled in his corn shocks. In May, when the new candle is tender and brittle as an asparagus shoot, a bird alighting on it will often break it off. Every spring I find a few such decapitated trees, each with its wilted candle lying in the grass. It is easy to infer what has happened, but in a decade of watching, I have never once seen a bird break a candle. It is an object lesson. One need not doubt the unseen. In June of each year, a few white pines suddenly show wilted candles, which shortly thereafter turn brown and die. A pine weevil has bored into the terminal bud cluster and deposited eggs. The grubs, when hatched, bore down along the pith and kill the shoot. Such a leaderless pine is doomed to frustration, for the surviving branches disagree among themselves who is to head the skyward march. They all do, and as a consequence, the tree remains a bush. It is a curious circumstance that only pines in full sunlight are bitten by weevils. Shaded pines are ignored. Such are the hidden uses of adversity. In October, my pines tell me, by their rubbed-off bark, when the bucks are beginning to feel their oats. A jack pine about 8 feet high, and standing alone, seems especially to incite in a buck the idea that the world needs prodding. Such a tree must perforce turn the other cheek also, and emerges much the worse for wear. The only element of justice in such combats is that the more the tree is punished, the more pitch the buck carries away on his not-so-shiny antlers. The chit-chat of the woods is sometimes hard to translate. Once in midwinter, I found in the droppings under a grouse roost some half-digested structures that I could not identify. They resembled miniature corn cobs about half an inch long. I examined samples of every local grouse food I could think of, but without finding any clue to the origin of the cobs. Finally, I cut open the terminal bud of a jack pine, and in its core, I found the answer. The grouse had eaten the buds, digested the pitch, rubbed off the scales in his gizzard, and left the cob, which was, in effect, the forthcoming candle. One might say that this grouse had been speculating in jack pine futures. The three species of pine native to Wisconsin, white, red, and jack, differ radically in their opinions about marriageable age. The precocious jack pine sometimes blooms and bears cones a year or two after leaving the nursery, and a few of my 13-year-old jacks already boast of grandchildren. My 13-year-old reds first bloomed this year, but my whites have not yet bloomed. They adhere closely to the Anglo-Saxon doctrine of free, white, and 21. Were it not for this wide diversity and social outlook, my red squirrels would be much curtailed in their bill of fare. Each year in midsummer, they start tearing up jackpine cones for the seeds, and no Labor Day picnic ever scattered more hulls and rinds over the landscape than they do. Under each tree, the remains of their annual feast lie in piles and heaps. Yet there are always cones to spare, as attested by their progeny popping up among the goldenrods. Few people know that pines bear flowers, and most of those who do are too prosy to see in this festival of bloom anything more than a routine biological function. all disillusioned folk should spend the second week in May in a pine woods, and such as wear glasses should take along an extra handkerchief. The prodigality of pine pollen should convince anyone of the reckless exuberance of the season, even when the song of the kinglet has failed to do so. Young white pines usually thrive best in the absence of their parents. I know of whole woodlots in which the younger generation, even when provided with a place in the sun, is dwarfed and spindled by its elders. Again, there are woodlots in which no such inhibition obtains. I wish I knew whether such differences lie in tolerance in the young, in the old, or in the soil. Pines, like people, are choosy about their associates, and do not succeed in suppressing their likes and dislikes. Thus, there is an affinity between white pines and dewberries, between red pines and flowering spurge, between jack pines and sweet fern. When I plant a white pine in a dewberry patch, I can safely predict that within a year he will develop a husky cluster of buds, and that his new needles will show that bluish bloom which bespeaks health and congenial company. He will outgrow and outbloom his fellows planted on the same day, with the same care, in the same soil, but in the company of grass. In October, I like to walk among these blue plumes, rising straight and stalwart from the red carpet of dewberry leaves. I wonder whether they are aware of their state of well-being. I know only that I am. Pines have earned the reputation of being evergreen by the same device that governments used to achieve the appearance of perpetuity, overlapping terms of office. By taking on new needles on the new growth of each year and discarding old needles at longer intervals, they have led the casual onlooker to believe that needles remain forever green. Each species of pine has its own constitution, which prescribes a term of office for needles appropriate to its way of life. Thus, the white pine retains its needles for a year and a half, the red and jack pines for 2 years and a half. Incoming needles take office in June, and outgoing needles write farewell addresses in October. All write the same thing, in the same tawny yellow ink, which by November turns brown. Then the needles fall, and are filed in the duff to enrich the wisdom of the stand. It is this accumulated wisdom that hushes the footsteps of whoever walks under pines. It is in midwinter that I sometimes glean from my pines something more important than woodlot politics and the news of the wind and weather. This is especially likely to happen on some gloomy evening when the snow has buried all irrelevant detail and the hush of elemental sadness lies heavy upon every living thing. Nevertheless, my pines, each with his burden of snow, are standing ramrod straight, rank upon rank, and in the dusk beyond I sense the presence of hundreds more. At such times I feel a curious transfusion of courage. 65290. To band a bird is to hold a ticket in a great lottery. Most of us hold tickets on our own survival, but we buy them from the insurance company, which knows too much to sell us a really sporting chance. It is an exercise in objectivity to hold a ticket on the banded sparrow that falleth, or on the banded chickadee that may someday re-enter your trap, and thus prove that he is still alive. The tyro gets his thrill from banding new birds. He plays a kind of game against himself, striving to break his previous score for total numbers. But to the old-timer, the banding of new birds becomes merely pleasant routine. The real thrill lies in the recapture of some bird banded long ago, some bird whose age, adventures, and previous condition of appetite are perhaps better known to you than the bird himself. Thus, in our family, the question whether Chickadee 65290 would survive for still another winter was, for 5 years, a sporting question of the first magnitude. Beginning a decade ago, we have trapped and banded most of the chickadees on our farm each winter. In early winter, the traps yield mostly unbanded birds. These presumably are mostly the young of the year, which, once banded, can thereafter be dated. As the winter wears on, unbanded birds cease to appear in the trap. We then know that the local population consists largely of marked birds. We can tell from the band numbers how many birds are present and how many of these are survivors from each previous year of banding. 65290 was one of seven chickadees constituting the class of 1937. When he first entered our trap, he showed no visible evidence of genius. Like his classmates, his valor for suet was greater than his discretion. Like his classmates, he bit my finger while being taken out of the trap. When banded and released, he fluttered up to a limb, pecked his new aluminum anklet in mild annoyance, shook his mussed feathers, cursed gently, and hurried away to catch up with the gang. It is doubtful whether he drew any philosophical deductions from his experience, such as, all is not ants' eggs that glitters, for he was caught again three times that same winter. By the second winter, our recaptures showed that the class of seven had shrunk to three, and by the third winter, to two. By the fifth winter, 65290 was the sole survivor of his generation. Signs of genius were still lacking, but of his extraordinary capacity for living, there was now historical proof. During his sixth winter, 65290 failed to reappear, and the verdict of missing in action is now confirmed by his absence during four subsequent trappings. At that, of 97 chicks banded during the decade, 65290 was the only one contriving to survive for five winters. Three reached 4 years, seven reached 3 years, 19 reached 2 years, and 67 disappeared after their first winter. Hence, if I were selling insurance to chicks, I would compute the premium with assurance. But this would raise the problem. In what currency would I pay the widows? I suppose in ant eggs. I know so little about birds that I can only speculate on why 65290 survived his fellows. Was he more clever in dodging his enemies? What enemies? A chickadee is almost too small to have any. That whimsical fellow called evolution, having enlarged the dinosaur until he tripped over his own toes, tried shrinking the chickadee until he was just too big to be snapped up by flycatchers as an insect, and just too little to be pursued by hawks and owls as meat. Then he regarded his handiwork and laughed. Everyone laughs at so small a bundle of large enthusiasms. The sparrowhawk, the screech owl, the shrike, and especially the midget saw-wet owl, might find it worthwhile to kill a chickadee. But I've only once found evidence of actual murder. A screech owl pellet contained one of my bands. Perhaps these small bandits have a fellow feeling for midgets. It seems likely that weather is the only killer so devoid of both humor and dimension as to kill a chickadee. I suspect that in the Chickadee Sunday School, two mortal sins are taught. Thou shalt not venture into windy places in winter. Thou shalt not get wet before a blizzard. I learned the second commandment, one drizzly winter dusk, while watching a band of chicks going to roost in my woods. The drizzle came out of the south, but I could tell it would turn northwest and bitter cold before morning. The chicks went to bed in a dead oak, the bark of which had peeled and warped into curls, cups, and hollows of various sizes, shapes, and exposures. The birds, selecting a roost dry against a south drizzle, but vulnerable to a north one, would surely be frozen by morning. The birds, selecting a roost dry from all sides, would awaken safe. This, I think, is the kind of wisdom that spells survival in chickdom and accounts for 65290 and his like. The chickadee's fear of windy places is easily deduced from his behavior. In winter, he ventures away from woods only on calm days, and the distance varies inversely as the breeze. I know several wind-swept woodlots that are chickless all winter, but are freely used at all other seasons. They are wind-swept because cows have browsed out the undergrowth. To the steam-heated banker who mortgages the farmer who needs more cows, who need more pasture, wind is a minor nuisance, except perhaps at the Flatiron Corner. To the chickadee, winter wind is the boundary of the habitable world. If the chickadee had an office, the maxim over his desk would say, "Keep calm." His behavior at the trap discloses the reason. Turn your trap so that he must enter with even a moderate wind at his tail, and all the king's horses cannot drag him to the bait. Turn it the other way, and your score may be good. Wind from behind blows cold and wet under the feathers, which are his portable roof and air conditioner. Nuthatches, juncos, tree sparrows, and woodpeckers likewise fear winds from behind, but their heating plants, and hence their wind tolerance, are larger in the order named. Books on nature seldom mention wind. They are written behind stoves. I suspect there is a third commandment in chickdom. Thou shalt investigate every loud noise. When we start chopping in our woods, the chicks at once appear and stay until the felled tree or riven log has exposed new insect eggs or pupae for their delectation. The discharge of a gun will likewise summon chicks, but with less satisfactory dividends. What served as their dinner bell before the day of axes, mauls, and guns? Presumably the crash of falling trees. In December 1940, an ice storm felled an extraordinary number of dead snags and living limbs in our woods. Our chicks scoffed at the trap for a month, being replete with the dividends of the storm. 65290 has long since gone to his reward. I hope that in his new woods, great oaks full of ants' eggs keep falling all day long, with never a wind to ruffle his composure or take the edge off his appetite. And I hope that he still wears my band. Part 2. The Quality of Landscape. Wisconsin. Marshland Elegy. A dawn wind stirs on the great marsh. With almost imperceptible slowness, it rolls a bank of fog across the wide morass. Like the white ghost of a glacier, the mists advance, riding over phalanxes of tamarack, sliding across bog meadows heavy with dew. A single silence hangs from horizon to horizon. Out of some far recess of the sky, a tinkling of little bells falls soft upon the listening land. Then again, silence. Now comes a bang of some sweet-throated hound, soon the clamor of a responding pack. Then a far clear blast of hunting horns, out of the sky into the fog. High horns, low horns, silence, and finally a pandemonium of trumpets, rattles, croaks, and cries that almost shakes the bog with its nearness, but without yet disclosing whence it comes. At last a glint of sun reveals the approach of a great echelon of birds. On motionless wing, they emerge from the lifting mists, sweep a final arc of sky, and settle into clangorous descending spirals to their feeding grounds. A new day has begun on the crane marsh. A sense of time lies thick and heavy on such a place. Yearly since the Ice Age, it has awakened each spring to the clangor of cranes. The peat layers that comprise the bog are laid down in the basin of an ancient lake. The cranes stand, as it were, upon the sodden pages of their own history. These peats are the compressed remains of the mosses that clog the pools, of the tamaracks that spread over the moss, of the cranes that bungled over the tamaracks since the retreat of the ice sheet. An endless caravan of generations has built of its own bones this bridge into the future, this habitat where the oncoming host again may live and breed and die. To what end? Out on the bog, a crane, gulping some luckless frog, springs his ungainly hulk into the air and flails the morning sun with mighty wings. The tamaracks re-echo with his bugled certitude. He seems to know. Our ability to perceive quality in nature begins, as in art, with the pretty. It expands through successive stages of the beautiful to values as yet uncaptured by language. The quality of crane lies, I think, in this higher gamut, as yet beyond the reach of words. This much, though, can be said. Our appreciation of the crane grows with a slow unraveling of earthly history. His tribe, we now know, stems out of the remote Eocene. The other members of the fauna in which he originated are long since entombed within the hills. When we hear his call, we hear no mere bird. He is the symbol of our untamable past, of that incredible sweep of millennia which underlies and conditions the daily affairs of birds and men. And so they live and have their being, these cranes, not in the constricted present, but in the wider reaches of evolutionary time. Their annual return is the ticking of the geologic clock. Upon the place of their return, they confer a peculiar distinction. Amid the endless mediocrity of the commonplace, a crane marsh holds a paleontological patent of nobility, won in the march of eons, and revocable only by shotgun. The sadness discernible in some marshes arises, perhaps, from their once having harbored cranes. Now they stand humbled, adrift in history. Some sense of this quality in cranes seems to have been felt by sportsmen and ornithologists of all ages. Upon such quarry as this, the Holy Roman Emperor Frederick loosed his gerfalcons. Upon such quarry as this, once swooped the hawks of Kublai Khan. Marco Polo tells us, he derives the highest amusement from sporting with gerfalcons and hawks. At Changanore, the Khan has a great palace surrounded by a fine plain where are found cranes in great numbers. He causes millet and other grains to be sown in order that the birds may not want. The ornithologist Bengt Betty sees cranes as a boy upon the Swedish heaths, forthwith made them his life work. He followed them to Africa and discovered their winter retreat on the White Nile. He says of his first encounter, "It was a spectacle which eclipsed the flight of the roc in the Thousand and One Nights." When the glacier came down out of the north, crunching hills and gouging valleys, some adventuring rampart of the ice climbed the Baraboo Hills and fell back into the outlet gorge of the Wisconsin River. The swollen waters backed up and formed a lake half as long as the state, bordered on the east by cliffs of ice and fed by the torrents that fell from melting mountains. The shorelines of this old lake are still visible. Its bottom is the bottom of the Great Marsh. The lake rose through the centuries, finally spilling over east of the Baraboo Range. There it cut a new channel for the river, and thus drained itself. To the residual lagoons came the cranes, bugling the defeat of the retreating winter, summoning the on-creeping host of living things to their collective task of marsh-building. Floating bogs of sphagnum moss clogged the lowered waters, filled them. Sledge and leatherleaf, tamarack and spruce, successively advanced over the bog, anchoring it by their root fabric, sucking out its water, making peat. The lagoons disappeared, but not the cranes. To the moss meadows that replaced the ancient waterways, they returned each spring to dance and bugle and rear their gangling sorrel-colored young. These, albeit birds, are not properly called chicks, but colts. I cannot explain why. On some dewy June morning, watch them gambol over their ancestral pastures at the heels of the roan mare, and you will see for yourself. One year, not long ago, a French trapper in buckskins pushed his canoe up one of the moss-clogged creeks that thread the Great Marsh. At this attempt to invade their miry stronghold, the cranes gave vent to loud and ribald laughter. A century or two later, Englishmen came in covered wagons. They chopped clearings in the timbered moraines that border the marsh, and in them planted corn and buckwheat. They did not intend, like a great Khan at Changanore, to feed the cranes. But the cranes do not question the intent of glaciers, emperors, or pioneers. They ate the grain, and when some irate farmer failed to concede their usufruct in his corn, they trumpeted a warning and sailed across the marsh to another farm. There was no alfalfa in those days, and the hill farms made poor hayland, especially in dry years. One dry year, someone set a fire in the tamarax. The burn grew up quickly to blue joint grass, which, when cleared of dead trees, made a dependable hay meadow. After that, each August, men appeared to cut hay. In winter, after the cranes had gone south, they drove wagons over the frozen bogs and hauled the hay to their farms in the hills. Yearly, they plied the marsh with fire and axe, and in two short decades, hay meadows dotted the whole expanse. Each August, when the haymakers came to pitch their camps, singing and drinking and lashing their teams with whip and tongue, the cranes whinnied to their colts and retreated to the far fastnesses. Red shitepokes, the haymakers called them, from the rusty hue which at that season often stains the battleship gray of crane plumage. After the hay was stacked and the marsh again their own, the cranes returned to call down out of October skies the migrant flocks from Canada. Together they wheeled over the new-cut stubbles and raided the corn until frosts gave the signal for the winter exodus. These hay meadow days were the Arcadian age for marsh dwellers. Man and beast, plant and soil, lived on with each other in mutual toleration, to the mutual benefit of all. The marsh might have kept on producing hay and prairie chickens, deer and muskrat, crane music and cranberries forever. The new overlords did not understand this. They did not include soil, plants, or birds in their ideas of mutuality. The dividends of such a balanced economy were too modest. They envisaged farms not only around, but in the marsh. An epidemic of ditch digging and land booming set in. The marsh was gridironed with drainage canals, speckled with new fields and farmsteads. But crops were poor and beset by frosts, to which the expensive ditches added an aftermath of debt. Farmers moved out. Peat beds dried, shrank, caught fire. Sun energy, out of the Pleistocene, shrouded the countryside in acrid smoke. No man raised his voice against the waste, only his nose against the smell. After a dry summer, not even the winter snows could extinguish the smoldering marsh. Great pockmarks were burned into field and meadow, the scars reaching down to the sands of the old lake, peat-covered these 100 centuries. Rank weeds sprang out of the ashes, to be followed after a year or two by aspen scrub. The cranes were hard put, their numbers shrinking with the remnants of unburned meadow. For them, the song of the power shovel came near being an elegy. The high priests of progress knew nothing of cranes and cared less. What is a species, more or less, among engineers? What good is an undrained marsh, anyhow? For a decade or two, crops grew poorer, fires deeper, wood fields larger, and cranes scarcer, year by year. Only re-flooding, it appeared, could keep the peat from burning. Meanwhile, cranberry growers had, by plugging drainage ditches, re-flooded a few spots and obtained good yields. Distant politicians bugled about marginal land, overproduction, unemployment relief, conservation. Economists and planners came to look at the marsh. Surveyors, technicians, CCCs buzzed about. A counter-epidemic of reflooding set in. Government bought land, resettled farmers, plugged ditches wholesale. Slowly the bogs are re-wetting. The firepox become ponds. Grass fires still burn, but they can no longer burn the wetted soil. All this, once the CCC camps were gone, was good for cranes, but not so the thickets of scrub popple that spread inexorably over the burns, and still less the maze of new roads that inevitably follow governmental conservation. To build a road is so much simpler than to think of what the country really needs. A roadless marsh is seemingly as worthless to the alphabetical conservationist as an undrained one was to the empire builders. Solitude, the one natural resource still undowered of alphabets, is so far recognized as valuable only by ornithologists and cranes. Thus always does history, whether of marsh marketplace, end in paradox. The ultimate value in these marshes is wildness. and the crane is wildness incarnate. But all conservation of wildness is self-defeating, for to cherish we must see and fondle, and when enough have seen and fondled, there is no wilderness left to cherish. Someday, perhaps in the very process of our benefactions, perhaps in the fullness of geologic time, the last crane will trumpet his farewell and spiral skyward from the great marsh. High out of the clouds will fall the sound of hunting horns, the bang of the phantom pack, the tinkle of little bells, and then a silence never to be broken, unless perchance in some far pasture of the Milky Way. The Sand Counties. Every profession keeps a small herd of epithets, and needs a pasture where they may run at large. Thus, economists must find free rein somewhere for their pet aspersions, such as submarginality, regression, and institutional rigidity. Within the ample reaches of the sand counties, these economic terms of reproach find beneficial exercise, free pasturage, and immunity from the gadflies of critical rebuttal. Soil experts, likewise, would have a hard life without the sand counties. Where else would their podzols, glaze, and anaerobics find a living? Social planners have, of late years, come to use the sand counties for a different, albeit somewhat parallel, purpose. The sandy region serves as a pale blank area of pleasing shape and size on those polka-dot maps where each dot represents 10 bathtubs or 5 women's auxiliaries or 1 mile of blacktop or a share in a bloodied bull. Such maps would become monotonous if stippled uniformly. In short, the sand counties are poor. Yet in the 1930s, when the alphabetical uplifts galloped like 40 horsemen across the big flats, exhorting the sand farmers to resettle elsewhere, these benighted folk did not want to go, even when baited with 3% at the federal land bank. I began to wonder why, and finally, to settle the question, I bought myself a sand farm. Sometimes in June, when I see unearned dividends of dew hung on every lupin, I have doubts about the real poverty of the sands. On solvent farmlands, lupins do not even grow, much less collect a daily rainbow of jewels. If they did, the weed control officer, who seldom sees a dewy dawn, would doubtless insist that they be cut. Do economists know about lupins? Perhaps the farmers, who did not want to move out of the sand counties, had some deep reason, rooted far back in history, for preferring to stay. I am reminded of this every April, when the pask flowers bloom on every gravelly ridge. Pasks do not say much, but I infer that their preference harks back to the glacier that put the gravel there. Only gravel ridges are poor enough to offer pasks full elbow room in April sun. They endure snows, sleets, and bitter winds for the privilege of blooming alone. There are other plants who seem to ask of this world not riches, but room. Such is the little sandwort that throws a white lace cap over the poorest hilltops just before the lupins splash them with blue. Sandworts simply refuse to live on a good farm, even on a very good farm, complete with rock garden and begonias. And then there is the little linaria, so small, so slender, and so blue, that you don't even see it until it is directly underfoot. Whoever saw a linaria except on a sand blow? Finally, there is Draba, beside whom even linaria is tall and ample. I have never met an economist who knows Draba. But if I were one, I should do all my economic pondering lying prone on the sand, with Draba at nose length. There are birds that are found only in the sand counties, for reasons sometimes easy, sometimes difficult to guess. The clay-colored sparrow is there, for the clear reason that he is enamored of jackpines, and jackpines of sand. The sandhill crane is there, for the clear reason that he is enamored of solitude, and there is none left elsewhere. But why do woodcocks prefer to nest in the sandy regions? Their preference is rooted in no such mundane matter as food, for earthworms are far more abundant on better soils. After years of study, I now think I know the reason. The male woodcock, while doing his painting prologue to the sky dance, is like a short lady in high heels. He does not show up to advantage in dense, tangled ground cover. But on the poorest sand streak of the poorest pasture or meadow of the sand counties, there is, in April at least, no ground cover at all, save only moss, draba, cardamony, sheep sorrel, and antenaria, all negligible impediments to a bird with short legs. Here the male woodcock can puff and strut and mince, not only without let or hindrance, but in full view of his audience, real or hoped for. This little circumstance, important for only an hour a day, for only 1 month of the year, perhaps for only one of the two sexes, and certainly wholly irrelevant to economic standards of living, determines the woodcock's choice of a home. The economists have not yet tried to resettle woodcocks. Odyssey. X had marked time in the limestone ledge since the Paleozoic seas covered the land. Time, to an atom locked in a rock, does not pass. The break came when a bur oak root nosed down a crack and began prying and sucking. In the flash of a century, the rock decayed, and X was pulled out and up into the world of living things. He helped build a flower, which became an acorn, which fattened a deer, which fed an Indian, all in a single year. From his birth in the Indian's bones, X joined again in chase and flight, feast and famine, hope and fear. He felt these things as changes in the little chemical pushes and pulls that tug timelessly at every atom. When the Indian took his leave of the prairie, X moldered briefly underground, only to embark on a second trip through the bloodstream of the land. This time it was a rootlet of blue stem that sucked him up and lodged him in a leaf that rode the green billows of the prairie June, sharing the common task of hoarding sunlight. To this leaf also fell an uncommon task, flicking shadows across a plover's eggs. The ecstatic plover, hovering overhead, poured praises on something perfect. Perhaps the eggs, perhaps the shadows, or perhaps the haze of pink flocks that lay on the prairie. When the departing plovers set wing for the Argentine, all the blue stems waved farewell with tall new tassels. When the first geese came out of the north, and all the blue stems glowed wine red, a four-handed deer mouse cut the leaf in which X lay, and buried it in an underground nest, as if to hide a bit of Indian summer from the thieving frosts. But a fox detained the mouse. Molds and fungi took the nest apart, and X lay in the soil again, footloose and fancy-free. Next he entered a tuft of side oats grama, a buffalo chip, and again the soil. Next a spiderwort, a rabbit, and an owl. Thence a tuft of spirobolus. All routines come to an end. This one ended with a prairie fire, which reduced the prairie plants to smoke, gas, and ashes. Phosphorus and potash atoms stayed in the ash, but the nitrogen atoms were gone with the wind. A spectator might, at this point, have predicted an early end of the biotic drama, for with fires exhausting the nitrogen, the soil might well have lost its plants and blown away. But the prairie had two strings to its bow. Fires thinned its grasses, but they thickened its stand of leguminous herbs. Prairie clover, bush clover, wild bean, vetch, lead plant, trefoil, and baptisia, each carrying its own bacteria housed in nodules on its rootlets. Each nodule pumped nitrogen out of the air into the plant, and then ultimately into the soil. Thus, the prairie savings bank took in more nitrogen from its legumes than it paid out to its fires. That the prairie is rich is known to the humblest deer mouse. Why the prairie is rich is a question seldom asked in all the still lapse of ages. Between each of his excursions through the biota, X lay in the soil and was carried by the rains, inch by inch, downhill. Living plants retarded the wash by impounding atoms, dead plants by locking them to their decayed tissues. Animals ate the plants and carried them briefly uphill or downhill, depending on whether they died or defecated higher or lower than they fed. No animal was aware that the altitude of his death was more important than his manner of dying.